Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. From Wondery.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm good, Justin. How are you?
I'm all right. We won't be putting out an episode next week. I know. You got to be patient.
We got some announcements.
Yes. Well, it's been quite a while. Generation Y is doing a live show next January. That's 2020. You can find the details on our social media sites. We aren't doing it alone. We're doing it with Charlie from Crime Lines and retired Sergeant Gary Jenkins from Gangland Wire.
Meanwhile, I had to interact with some wonderful police officers over in Kansas City, Kansas. So if you are a police officer in KCK, I want to thank you for your professionalism and your understanding. I couldn't have had a better experience.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I remember this case vividly when it happened. It was such a huge news event. It happened in Los Angeles. There had been multiple movies out about bank robberies and whatnot. It was a beautiful Friday morning in Los Angeles, California. It would be shattered with gunfire, and law enforcement would come under attack by two vicious bank robbers. And I think that's an understatement of the year. This case would stun the nation and actually pave the way for the militarization of our nation's top police forces. So with that, what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
We're talking about the North Hollywood shootout.
That's how it's typically referred to. If you do a Google search for North Hollywood shooting, you'll get 100 different shootings that have happened in the last month. So make sure you put shootout there or bank robbery, something to that effect. If you haven't seen the footage from this, go out to YouTube. There's a zillion different videos out there that show different angles, helicopter footage, all kinds of documentaries about it. When did this happen?
This happened February 28th, 1997, between 9:17 a.m. and 10:01 a.m.
Now, this is on a Friday because people go to banks on Friday to cash their paychecks. So these bank robbers thought, we're going to go on a Friday when the bank's going to have the most money, first thing in the morning when they open. That was their plan. And you'll find out, as we tell the story, that it was very calculated. At least one of these guys was a tactician.
The bank in this case was Bank of America. It was on 6600 Laurel Canyon Boulevard in North Hollywood.
I used to live a few miles from there in Van Nuys, so I know exactly where this bank is at. So who are these two guys that decided to go all Grand Theft Auto and try to take on the entire LAPD?
They were Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Matasarenu.
Phillips was born Larry Eugene Warfel. He was born in 1970. He's 6 years older than me.
He had the name Warfel because his father gave him an alias. His father was, shall we say, a bit of a troublemaker.
He was a criminal, yeah.
Exactly. And in fact, when he was born, the address given to the hospital was an address that really didn't exist. So even from the beginning, there's just nothing honest about Larry Phillips Sr.
And what does that say? How do we expect his son to turn out with this?
His dad was constantly in trouble with the law and had no love for law enforcement or the government. It would be probably about 17 years before Larry Phillips Jr. would change his name and take the name Phillips, which was their actual name. But let's talk about some of the trouble that his father got into. In 1967, Larry Phillips Sr. was arrested in Denver, Colorado. He had been with some friends, and as a prank, a drunken prank, they decided to dig up a coffin and remove the head from a body.
Yeah, that's a funny prank. No, that's downright creepy and weird.
He was sent to a Colorado State Reformatory. In 1968, he was paroled. But then he turned around and robbed a gas station. He went back to the reformatory with a potential 10-year sentence. Now, in the late 60s, Larry Phillips Sr. met his, well, the future mother of his children. He was still on the run, still causing trouble, still committing crimes. They ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah. While they were there, Phillips Sr. was approached by a police officer who said, hey, why don't you get in my patrol car while I run a check on you?
So he was being detained because he was probably matching the description of some crime that had just happened.
Apparently, and this was unexpected because he was so used to using aliases, but he gave the officer his actual name. And it didn't take long
before red flags popped up on the screen, essentially. But he was slick. He ran from the car, and despite officers trying to track him down, they couldn't find him. But he does pop back up, and this is in September of 1970, when he's at a hospital with his significant other and their new baby, who just happens to be Larry Phillips Jr. Now, you can imagine Larry Phillips Jr. has parents who are constantly on the run, moving around and committing crimes. I wonder what kind of childhood he'll have. Now, eventually, Larry Phillips Jr.'s parents will split, but his dad remained in his life here and there. He would pop up from time to time and visit him. And it's said that he would be the fun dad. So, you know, little Jr. wanted to go fishing or swimming, whatever he wanted to do, they would go and do stuff. It's also said that Sr., he exerted a strong influence over his son, letting him know his ideologies. And as a criminal, what were they? What were his ideologies, Justin?
Well, it's pretty much, you have to take what's yours. You have to take it. You don't work for it. You just get it. Screw anyone that gets in your way. And you say he's instilled this upon his son, and I will only correct you in the sense that he had sons. Phillips' brother would hang out with Phillips, and Phillips would regurgitate all the things that dad told him, and they would drive around in like wealthy neighborhoods and whatnot. And Phillips would just be pissed at wealthy people. And he would like to try to imagine himself living in these big houses and wearing suits and having success. But it wasn't a, oh, I want to be that successful person. It was, that person doesn't deserve it. I do. It's kind of creepy. They would actually drive around rich neighborhoods and just be pissed off at rich people.
It's like he's stalking wealthy people, just envious of what they have and thinking, if I decide to, I can have everything that's theirs. It's actually mine. It's in 1986 that Larry Phillips Jr.'s mother, who's now going by the name Dorothy Clay, moved to Los Angeles.
And she took her son with her.
Now, one of the things that Larry also got, you know, in addition to this hatred for wealthy people and authority figures, was he got a love for bodybuilding from his dad. Later on, if you watch footage of the shootout, you'll see he looks like a pretty strong guy. And that's because bodybuilding was one of his passions. So one of the things that he would do is he had a gym membership and would work out religiously. But at some point, he got into real estate.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the late 80s. And trust me, this is not a legitimate business that he's getting into, because he's not treating it that way. Again, this is a guy who takes what he wants. So it's either a scam or it's just an outright robbery.
Well, essentially, he would find a place that just went on the market, and he would put an ad out to rent it. Whoever would reply to the ad, he would say, I need a down payment. These people just bought the property and they want to rent it immediately. And he would take their money and run. Meanwhile, he was actually applying for his real estate license. And during the background check, he didn't disclose that he had actually been arrested for shoplifting over $400 worth of clothing from a Sears. I mean,
and why would he disclose that?
Yeah. I mean, so his criminal background is started at a very young age, obviously instilled by his father, when he's denied his real estate license. For a split second, I thought, man, I wonder if they actually would have approved this license if he would have gone the straight and narrow. But then as soon as I read about the whole bait and switch with renters and stealing their money, I'm like, oh no, this guy was a con through and through.
Well, in the early 90s, he was actually arrested for real estate fraud.
He ended up having to pay back to separate mortgage companies over $100,000 in restitution. This is a big deal, especially back in the early 90s.
Now, the way I understand it was Larry didn't necessarily have friends. He more or less had people, and this is information that's really covered well in the Los Angeles Times. They did a really big piece on this, but he had a brother who didn't want to be known, but he said that the only people that Larry let into his life were people that he was going to use for some purpose.
Yeah, he didn't have friends. He had people that he would use and mooch off of, or he always had an angle. He was always vying for something.
And in this case, he ends up meeting a guy named Emil Matasarenu. We'll just call him Emil. His name's actually a lot longer than that, but I don't think I'm going to attempt the full pronunciation of his name. But Emil was 4 years older than Larry Phillips Jr. His parents came here from Romania.
He was older, but it's said that he was, I don't know, immature for his age and possibly unsocialized. And it might be due to him immigrating here from Romania and just not making a lot of friends. But people called Emil not slow, but just not very social, not very friendly.
Well, and part of that might be because it's said that he was bullied in school. That might be because he was from another country. That could be it. Or, I mean, I remember when I was in school, people would pick on you for just the smallest things. If you weren't already in a clique, you very well could end up being a victim. He ended up really, in the end, he was working for his mother, and she had a state care license, and she wanted to take care of disabled adults. That was her business. It seemed like it was sort of a lucrative business, right? Until something happened.
Well, between staying up with regulations and whatnot with the state and falling behind on rent payments, they were struggling.
Yeah, it could have been a lucrative business, but there was some management issues going on. This all really happened around the early 80s. I think this set up Emil for this idea that the world owed him more than he was getting, you know, because he wasn't getting a fair shake. I mean, he and his mother were trying to make it in America, and socially he wasn't doing well, and business-wise, they ended up not doing well. So things sort of fell apart.
So their company that they had together folded because they weren't keeping up with their license, their permits, and it was found that they were possibly abusing or neglecting some of the disabled adults that were under their care. So they go out of business, and Emil is just trying to do his best to make ends meet at this point.
In 1988, Emil graduated from DeVry, and he also became a naturalized American citizen. He also meets in 1989 a man by the name of Larry Phillips Jr., and well, this ends up being an issue because Emil is not the leader here. He's not the guy that's going to stick up for himself or bring any sort of contradiction to Larry's suggestions.
Well, they met at Gold's Gym where they're working out together, and Larry's the dominant one. Larry's the one that's going to talk to you and try to sell you on his ideas. And Emil is just taking suggestion. And he's just trying to make ends meet. And if somebody's trying to sell him on a dream, he's probably going to be okay with that. They both develop a fascination with guns and start collecting guns. Both of these guys would end up meeting significant others in their life and getting married. But even Emil's choice in spouse was sort of at the direction of Larry Phillips, right?
Yeah, Larry told him to take a wife who was not American, and that was a point he stressed. And Emil took his advice. He, you know, in 1993, he went on a trip to Romania to get his grandmother and bring her back to the States. And while he was over there to get her, he met a woman named Christian. They even had a son together, Emil Jr. But that marriage lasted, I'd say, about 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, you got to realize that his job as a computer consultant wasn't exactly working out, and The friends he was keeping weren't the best influence on him. And that becomes very obvious in 1993.
So the two of them, Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Matasarenu, robbed a First Bank-owned armored car in Littleton, Colorado on July 20th, 1993. And because of that success, they make another hit.
Well, and then in October of 1993, they've moved on to Glendale, California. They're driving a rental, which happens to be a Ford Thunderbird, and they're speeding away from a gas station, which this is going to get the attention of police officers. They were pursued by a cop, but they didn't pull over right away. And when the officer finally got them to pull over, he said, "Didn't you see me?" Of course, Phillips, who's driving, says, "No, I just saw you right before I pulled over." He asks Phillips for his driver's license, and Larry Phillips says he doesn't have one, or he left it at home. The officer asks who the car belongs to, and Emil says that the car belongs to Phillips' mother, but it's a rental car. It doesn't belong to either one of them. So the cops already on edge with these guys and asks them to step out of the vehicle, or at least ask Philip to step out of the vehicle. He notices that both of the men are armed with Glock 9mm pistols. That's not a good thing. And he goes on to search the vehicle, and he finds a lot of really suspicious items. And at that point, the two men are placed under arrest because they're giving false names, they're not giving any useful information, and they have multiple semi-automatic rifles, multiple pistols, thousands of rounds of ammunition, 6 smoke bombs, 2 improvised explosive devices, a gas mask, body armor, level 3A vests, they have police scanners, sunglasses, gloves, ski masks, stopwatches, spray cans, and 3 different California license plates, and over $1,600 in cash. I wonder what these guys are up to. I'm sure they're just traveling.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty obvious what's going on here.
So what do they get charged with, Aaron?
Now, there's a book that goes into detail on what this officer discovered. And it's all part of this stop and arrest of these two individuals. But the book is Would You Convict? And it's by Paul H. Robinson. Some of the charges are unlawful weapons activity, conspiracy to commit robbery, grand theft auto, carrying and concealing loaded firearms, and perjury. I mean, they gave, you know, false names, false information, you name it. This is literally catching two criminals prior to a criminal act.
They are arrested. They're put behind bars. They await trial. They go to trial. And due to a lack of evidence, they get to plea bargain down. And a lot of these charges are dropped to the point where they're sentenced to 99 days and 71 days behind bars, plus 36 days of probation for each of them. So Phillips gets literally 100 days and Emil gets 71 days. These guys were going to rob a bank and they're spending 3 months behind bars.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts, and when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Now, part of their release, they negotiated with the judge and with the court systems to get back some of their stuff to pay their court fines and court costs. So a lot of their guns were returned to them. Wow. Missed opportunity there. So what do they do with these guns that they got back, Aaron?
July 14th, 1995. This is less than 2 years after the other incident. Around 12:25 in the afternoon, they robbed an armored car owned by Brinks. I'm sure many people have seen these around. With them, they had automatic weapons, and they shot the vehicle's rear door open to get inside. And the security guard of the Brinks vehicle was a 51-year-old man by the name of Herman Dwight Cook. He was killed in this incident, and the vehicle's driver was Felipe Cortez, who was 53 years old. He was injured. This is a very violent incident to snatch money, and it shows these guys aren't done by a long shot. This is their life, robbing banks, robbing armored cars.
Yeah, and it's March 27th, 1996. They hit another Brinks armored vehicle. They fire upon it. The driver was slightly injured by broken glass, but the armor car sped off. So they didn't succeed in this robbery attempt, but they definitely just started shooting at an armored car to get it to stop so they could rob him.
And it's not confirmed it was these two, but by most accounts it is because it fits their MO.
May 2nd, 1996, they robbed a bank instead of hitting an armored car. They stormed into Bank of America in Van Nuys, where I used to live, sometime before 10 a.m. And they walk in, they shoot their weapons off into the air. And this is called a takeover robbery. They don't go up to the cashier or the teller and hand them a note. They come in and just start shooting, tell everybody to get down and open the safe. It's a very violent, aggressive takeover. From this heist, they will take $755,048. That's a lot of money for two losers.
Later that month, May 31st, 1996, at just after 10 a.m., Phillips Jr. and Matasarenu robbed another Bank of America. They left with $794,200, and in their wake, they left two bank tellers injured.
Again, in security camera footage, you see these two guys coming in, and there's a lot of people that are referred to as this, but these guys had been called AK bandits at some point because they would walk into banks with AK-47s or AK-47 variants. It might not have been that exact weapon, but they're rifles that look very similar and behave in a similar manner and fire the same caliber of ammo. And they would just come in and shoot the place up. Some of these banks have bulletproof glass or some sort of devices to keep the tellers away from the public. They would just use their guns to shoot through these locks and get behind the counters and strong arm the managers of the bank to open up the safes.
And this isn't common.
No.
I mean, a lot of robberies tend to be very subtle, where a note is passed. But these guys, there has to be some thrill in this for them. So let's move on to Friday, February 28th, 1997. This is the Bank of America, which is on Laurel Canyon Boulevard in North Hollywood.
Now, Larry Phillips Jr. has staked this bank out. They're assuming that the Friday is going to have more cash in the safe. They've watched the schedules. They've really thought this out. And they even got it down to an 8-minute response time from local police officers. They know they need to get the manager to open up that safe, and they need to get the hell out of there before 8 minutes is up. They've timed this out. They think they have a perfect plan. And so far, they've been getting away with it.
And they come prepared. They have, thousands of rounds of ammunition. They have automatic rifles. They have pistols. They even have body armor.
Now, Larry Phillips Jr., essentially, he has a level 3A vest that he's wearing. And then he has other Kevlar vests that he's sewed or stitched together to cover his arms, his pelvic region, and his legs.
Like, he's fully covered.
Yeah. Emil, he doesn't have his whole body covered. He's really just wearing a vest over his torso, but his legs and arms are exposed. And of course, he's wearing clothing on top of that, so you don't realize that he's wearing this body armor. And excuse us if we refer to it as a bulletproof vest. That just seems to be the common term for it. I know it's ballistics vest or Kevlar vest, but this is what they're wearing. And Phillips Jr. is definitely a walking armored person at this point. They also have obtained steel jacketed rounds. These will be referred to as armor piercing rounds, but I don't know if they really bought them for more penetration capabilities, but steel jacketed rounds happen to be less expensive than the regular rounds for AK-47s and whatnot. I think it might have just been they were buying thousands and thousands of rounds, so they bought these steel jacketed rounds for a price reduction as opposed to any kind of tactical advantage that they would have.
Well, the idea was not to get into a firefight at all. They just wanted to rob the bank and get away, hence the 8-minute window.
Yeah, and they have drum magazines on their AK-47 variants and AR-15 variants that hold 100 rounds. Also, it's been reported just about everywhere you read about this case that they took phenobarbital, or which is essentially a muscle relaxer or sedative, before they walked into the bank. Now, I was surprised that they would take a muscle relaxer. I would just assume someone would take cocaine or meth or an upper. But the more you think about it, the more a muscle relaxer or a sedative would actually give them an edge to stay calm in such a heightened situation. Because if you can hold your weapon steady, you can fire it a lot better. What do you think, Aaron?
I know that Larry's brother, he doesn't agree with this. He thinks that his brother Larry would never take something like that because he was so into working out that he was very careful about what he put into his body. There's also this idea, though, that he was such a planner and that he was so into this kind of thing that he wouldn't have needed this in the first place, and he wouldn't need any help in doing it, at least as far as his nerves went.
See, I think as a bodybuilder, you can pull muscles, you can injure yourself, whatnot. So taking a muscle relaxer isn't that big of a deal. I think people associate drug user with illegal street drugs, but I don't think, especially back then, that they associated it with prescription drugs.
Well, it could be said his drug was robbing banks.
This is true. I think of the movie Point Break. It was a bunch of adrenaline junkies always looking for a fix, and one of those fixes was robbing banks. So they're loaded for bear, and they're heading towards the Bank of America, and it's 9:17 a.m. on February 28th, 1997.
So they enter the bank, and they fire rounds into the ceiling. They're letting the bank know what their intent is, but what they don't know is when they've entered the bank, there are already two officers that saw them go in and are calling in for backup.
So their 8-minute window is blown immediately because they're walking into the bank with automatic rifles and they're spotted. So LAPD is already in the know that a 211 is in progress. Shots are fired and they're sending cops that direction. But Phillips and Emil, this is just another day for them, and they're doing their thing and screaming at the bank employees and threatening the security guards, trying to get into the safe, which the safe at this Bank of America requires two keys. So they have to track down the manager, and then they have to track down the assistant manager, get the two keys, get this door open. It's all delays in their plan. Once they get the safe open, there's not that much money in it. Apparently, there was a policy change with the bank where they weren't going to keep $1 million at the bank. So they get the safe open. They're telling the manager to put the money in the bag. Of course, the manager is sticking dye packs in the bag too, which these are blue dye packs that explode once they leave the location of the bank and stain all the money with blue dye, so it's unusable. But because they're only able to get like $300,000, and they start shooting their guns into the safe and into the vault because they're already upset that this entire bank robbery is not going as planned.
So because this was called in, they had small teams of officers essentially attempting to surround the different parts of the bank. And so they had some officers on the northeastern side, some on the southern side, some on the western side, the northern side. They're doing their best to try and contain these robbers. Now, because they have an 8-minute window, Larry Phillips Jr. starts to exit the bank out of the north side at 9:24 a.m. That's 7 minutes after they had entered the bank.
When he walks outside, he notices there's half dozen police setting up just across the street, across the parking lots, pointing their guns at him. He comes out, looks around, actually walks back into the bank for a second, probably to let Emil know, hey, cops are here. And then he comes back out, raises his rifle, and starts firing. And this is probably, one, a surprise to the police because, let's get this out of the way, Los Angeles used to be one of the bank robbery capitals of America. And there's even a dentist office across the street where the dentist says, like, oh yeah, this is like the fifth robbery we've seen. So he wasn't even worried about it. But one, they've never seen bank robbers take essentially automatic weapons to a bank robbery. And they absolutely have never been fired upon with a fully automatic machine gun. So this is probably the first oh crap moment for the LAPD.
And Phillips Jr. ended up wounding 7 officers.
Like we said, they had steel jacketed rounds, but it's kind of a moot point because Hollywood has really lied to us about what bullets can really do. And rifle rounds will pass right through a car, especially a 7.62 round or 223 rounds. They can go right through vehicles. They can go right through walls. And the AK-47 round will definitely go through concrete block walls. And all of these calibers that I just named off will pass right through a Kevlar vest like it's butter. They don't need armor-piercing rounds. Bulletproof vests are only made, or at least the ones the cops were wearing back then, are only made for pistol rounds. They're only going to stop handguns and shotgun rounds. They're not going to stop a rifle round. And of course, the police at this time are only carrying revolvers like 38s, 9mm Berettas, and 12-gauge shotguns with double-aught buck. They don't have any weapons that can penetrate a Kevlar vest. But our two bank robbers, that's what they're carrying, is rifles that are going to shoot right through anything that's in their way.
The officers are doing their best to try and take these guys down, but they're armed with handguns and shotguns. The shotguns don't have the range, and the pistols they're using, they're not able to penetrate the armor. So all they can do is attempt to provide some distraction, I guess, while injured officers are rescued by other officers coming onto the scene. And in the meantime, some of the officers end up having to go to a gun store to get properly armed.
Yeah, they actually find a gun store, because this is the second oh crap moment for the police officers, is when multiple officers, the dozen or so that were the first responders here, have shot these guys. They know they've hit them. There was a rookie officer with a 12-gauge shotgun behind the locksmith kiosk that was across the parking lot. He leveled his shotgun at Phillips Jr., shot him twice in the back, actually saw some of the pellets ripping through Phillips' clothes and bounce off. Phillips, well, being shot twice with a 12-gauge shotgun in the back and it not doing anything, he turned around and just sprayed and prayed, you know, at this rookie officer. Now, there was actually two detectives that had responded, and these detectives, they're not wearing any body armor because they're so used to bank robbers just giving up or just negotiating or what have you. And so these two detectives aren't wearing any protection. And when Phillips turns around and just sprays a huge burst at this officer, the bullets are flying right through this kiosk. And this officer actually jumps on the female detective to protect her because he is wearing body armor. But these bullets fly right through this building and right through this officer's vest. And actually, he gets severely injured while he's trying to protect the female detective.
It's just after 9:30 when these two robbers try to make their getaway, and their plan is to make it to their car, which is a Chevrolet Celebrity, and Matasarenu gets into the car. He's going to drive it away, and Phillips Jr. is going to walk alongside it and use it as cover as he tries to keep the officers at bay.
So this is a weird scenario, because I would have just assumed they both would have jumped in the car and taken off. But apparently, Emil had been hit in the leg, so walking for him wasn't working out. That's why he jumped in the car. He probably expected Phillips to get in the car also, but Phillips, I don't know, somewhere between the vault being half full, the die packs going off, and being ambushed by the LAPD, he's not having it, and he just wants to continue the fight and continue shooting at these police officers. Now, he's shooting an AK full auto. That's the most inaccurate way you can shoot one of these rifles. Semi-auto, you can actually find your targets and pick them off. But essentially, I think he spent more time in the gym working on his bodybuilding than he did actually firing and learning how to use his weapons. Because he's missing a lot. He's firing hundreds of rounds. And this is probably more considered suppressive fire, you know, firing for effect as opposed to firing to actually kill his intended target. Although he definitely has no qualms about killing anyone that's in his way.
Now, while some officers are collecting new weapons from a gun shop, the LAPD SWAT is arriving on the scene. This is at 9:42 a.m.
Because they are reporting, we're shooting these guys and they're not going down. And they're calling for headshots, but I mean, this isn't a zombie movie where everyone can just go, oh, shoot him in the head. When you're 30, 40 yards away and you're being shot at with automatic fire, you're not going to shoot somebody in the head that easy. That just doesn't happen. It's hard enough to hit them in their body. So they're trying to get weapons that will penetrate body armor, and the SWAT teams show up. Some of these SWAT guys were literally doing other things like working out at gyms themselves. They're showing up in their workout clothes, like shorts, t-shirt and shorts, and arming up and putting on vests and whatnot. Meanwhile, there's so many officers down that they keep calling in officer down, officer down. And dispatch is confused because they've never had multiple officers down like this. So they're screaming back at the officers saying, how many are down? Is it one? The officers are screaming back, no, more than one, because There's like seven at this point. It's only 18 minutes into this firefight, and over seven cops have been hit and are bleeding. And no one can get to them because they're trapped behind cars or behind buildings, and there's nowhere to go.
And Matt Asarenu is trying to get this getaway car out of the parking lot, and he's shot twice more.
And this car is just getting riddled with bullets. So I think all four tires have been shot out. So he's not able to drive very fast. He's probably just doing 2 to 4 miles per hour while Phillips is walking slowly, meticulously behind him, just shooting at everything that moves. And the trunk of this vehicle is full of more guns, explosive devices, and a helicopter's flying overhead reporting on this. I think it's actually a police helicopter because they called in air support. And at this point, Phillips Jr. switches from his AK variant to an HK. That's a 308 automatic rifle. And he starts shooting at that helicopter. Now a 308, that's a common deer hunting round. You take out large animals with this. These bullets can pass through just about anything that they're shooting at. Luckily, the helicopter pilot was, I guess, an ex-combat pilot from Vietnam. So he was used to being shot at, although he doesn't like being shot at, but he just turned around and got out of range.
It's also reported that some of the officers or civilians that were hit, they weren't necessarily hit by bullets. Some of them were hit by debris from bullets hitting other things like the cement or glass, what have you.
And the bullets, you know, when they hit certain things, they can't explode and you get fragmentation from the bullets themselves. So two officers are hit. One has a shard of metal out of his ankle. The other one is been hit in his buttocks. The one that has the shard on his ankle drags the other guy into the local dentist office. And the dentist starts trying to do whatever first aid, whatever he can to save these officers' lives. Meanwhile, everyone in the dentist office has evacuated, except for the dentist, essentially, because he was like, this is just another bank robbery. I want to watch. But at some point, the two men split. Phillips thinks the car situation is a losing strategy, I guess, and he peels off while Emil is driving slowly down the road and starts to attempt to carjack other vehicles.
Phillips at that point was using an HK M91A3. It's a semi-automatic rifle. And while a lot of the gunfire coming his way isn't able to make it past his armor, it does start striking the weapon. And he ends up losing that weapon.
It said that a bullet struck the weapon. Possibly fragments from that hit his left wrist. So that weapon is now disabled. He reverts back to his AK variants, but he's not able to shoot as well because one of his hands is now injured. But this AK variant is jamming up, and it's possible that it's jamming because they're using the steel jacketed rounds. I guess they're kind of crappy rounds and don't feed well. So this weapon is jamming, and he gets a stovepipe jam, which is where the empty shell gets caught facing straight up. Now, normally, if you have two functional hands, you can just brush it off and re-engage. But since one of his hands is already injured, he's not able to clear the jam. So he drops that weapon and pulls out his pistol.
Now, his Beretta, well, this is the point where he's now outgunned.
At least the police, they're using Berettas and shotguns on him. So he's using the same weapon as the police officers. And he's been shot dozens of times. Some of those bullets have found a way through his armor. But with the, I'm assuming the effects of the drugs and adrenaline and whatnot, he's still going. And he's now firing at these officers. The officers don't really know where he's at. He was behind the semi-truck. One officer, Caparelli, was engaging these guys over and over again, even though he was completely outgunned. But when Phillips Jr. was down to a 9mm, he jumped out and actually engaged him like one-on-one and fired at Phillips. They were just across an intersection from each other, and they're just gunning at each other endlessly. And this officer hit Phillips, I guess, in the thumb, and Phillips actually drops his 9mm at that point. I guess with two hands being injured and not really being able to continue this fight, Phillips decides to stop fighting, I guess. Is that one way to put it?
Yeah, it's possible that he decided to take the easy way out at that point and take his own life. But there is a possibility that he was simply trying to reload his weapon and it went off. After all, both of his hands were injured. It just really depends on how you see this. I mean, is this guy who was going to fight to the end? Because up to this point, he had engaged in this shootout with many, many officers and had used multiple weapons. So you wonder, why would he decide to end his own life?
I think he was a control freak and he was going to control his own life and even the end of it. It appears that he puts the barrel of his Beretta underneath his chin and pulls the trigger. It doesn't, and he still had ammo in there. Now, he could have done a tactical reload and the gun would have gone off, but I think he decided to take his own life at that point. I figure he'd just given up, because in GTA world, he's at 5 stars police rating and he's not going to win this fight anymore.
He has no way to get out of there.
No. Simultaneously, the cops came around the corner and were all shooting him, and another bullet made its way through his armor and severed Phillips' spine, and he fell to the ground. He was probably dead from the self-inflicted gunshot wound, but they kept shooting him for a good probably 30, 45 seconds after he fell, just riddling his body with bullets.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Meanwhile,
his buddy Emil, this is just before 10 a.m., he's trying to get into this Jeep that he's trying to commandeer.
Yeah, he rolled up on a civilian that was driving by and just shot at him through his own windshield. And the driver of that vehicle just jumped out and took off. His name was Bill Maher. And Emil pulls up next to the truck and casually gets out, right?
Yeah, it's weird. He starts transferring weapons from the one vehicle to the other. And this truck is a 1963 Jeep Cherokee pickup truck. It's an older vehicle. And isn't it a manual transmission?
Yeah, I've heard 3 different stories about this. I've heard that Emil didn't know how to drive a manual. I heard that it had some sort of starter button on it. And I've heard that Bill, the driver, just took his keys and ran. So there weren't any keys in the truck. I've heard 3 different versions of the story. But regardless, it doesn't matter.
It's not a getaway vehicle.
No. Emil meticulously, slowly just transfers all his weapons to the truck, jumps in the truck, can't get away. And at this point, SWAT's pulling up. They've loaded up a cop car full of SWAT guys, and they're driving towards the truck. Now, it's said that they thought the driver of the truck was being held hostage, and they were going to free him. What they didn't know was the only person there was Emil. And when they rolled up, Emil immediately just takes cover behind his own car and gives them a spray of automatic bullets.
Which again, like you said, it's not an accurate way to try and hit your target, but it is intimidating. The only problem is he's trying to be intimidating to some SWAT officers who have AR-15s and at this point aren't intimidated because they're looking to bring down someone who has taken down a number of their own.
The video footage of this is insane to watch. The three SWAT officers exit the vehicle, exit their cop car, take up positions behind the cop car, and start exchanging fire with Emil. But they're having to get close to the ground because, again, these rounds are just passing right through the cars. But while they're on the ground, they're looking underneath all the cars, and this is sort of the Achilles heel of the whole situation. What do they see, Aaron?
They see that he doesn't have any armor on his legs, so they now have a new target, and I think over 20 bullets strike Emil's legs.
Yeah. They sweep the leg.
He goes down and they immediately surround him. I think they even kick him to the ground. They make sure that he's really down flat.
Yeah, Emil has dropped his weapons and essentially given up. He's been hit 29 times that have actually, you know, these are bullets that have actually penetrated and passed through. This includes 27 other shots that broken his skin or grazed him. So this man's been shot over 50 times. Phillips Jr., he was hit 11 times. He was hit in the tailbone by one of those shotgun blasts that the rookie had given him. He'd been hit in the arms, the back, and obviously the head, and then eventually his spine.
So this shootout, this North Hollywood shootout, comes to an end officially at 10:01 a.m., and emergency personnel are dispatched to the area, of course. Other officers are coming in. SWAT team is going into the bank to rescue the people there. Emil Matasarenu isn't tended to by emergency personnel. EMTs do not reach him. Shortly after 11 in the morning, he died.
Most gunfights last 3 seconds or less. This gunfight lasted 44 minutes. Okay? This is a very abnormal situation. Also, they found IEDs in the vehicle. When the officers had taken out Phillips Jr., they heard a hissing sound. They actually thought that he might have had some sort of bomb or booby trap on him and on his body. What they actually were hearing was air coming out of the truck, one of the tires, but they didn't know. They knew that these guys had all kinds of weapons and all kinds of bombs. And here we have Emil laying there bleeding, screaming at the cops to shoot him, give him one in the head, still being defiant after being shot over 50 times. Police officers are hanging out, waiting for the area to be secure, waiting to know that the, you know, the all clear has been given, and they're waiting for the bomb squad to show up to disable these devices. If they would have given Emil basic first aid treatment, they might have been able to save his life. If they would have dragged his bullet-riddled body away from the car and towards the ambulances, sure, they could have maybe saved his life. But this man had just kept the entire LAPD at bay for 44 minutes with fully automatic weapons. Do you think that the police are making his health the priority right now?
Well, and that's the thing where you have people saying they let him die. And if you watch the video of the two officers that are nearby, a detective and an officer who are right by Emil as he's bleeding to death, they don't look sympathetic, but why would they? You know? And so if you simply watch the video, you'll get this idea that they let him die and they wanted him to die, but it probably was a lot more complex than that because the way that they had this whole shootout, they were armed to the teeth and then some. This is a scene that cannot be taken lightly. The officers can't just assume that everything's clear, and you can't just send more people into a dangerous area. You know, if it comes down to it, who are you going to be worried about? Are you going to worry about the guy who tried to murder a bunch of civilians and police? Or would you worry about potentially having other people injured just to save this one guy's life?
I mean, I want law enforcement to do everything they can to save somebody's life and administer first aid. But in this situation, like, there's something that's happened that's never happened before. Something that is so crazy. And it takes time for them to secure the perimeter, to understand how many shooters were involved. Are there any bombs or incendiary devices on this man's body or in his car? There's a lot of factors there. I don't think the police did anything egregious here. I think they did their best to put down a crazy situation and get control of it.
Well, because these two guys are dead, we don't have a trial.
Miraculously, they're the only two people that died in this situation. We have multiple officers injured and civilians, but the only fatalities are Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Matasarenu.
We started off talking about the militarization of the nation's top police forces, and I guess you could say this incident taught them that they didn't have the means to put an end to such a situation quickly. That's why it lasted 44 minutes.
Yeah, and as soon as the SWAT team shows up, they put him down real quick. That shootout lasted less than 30 seconds because the SWAT team was armed with AR-15s that could take care of this situation. This is a rallying cry for police officers, especially the LAPD. Give us something. Arm us so we can actually fight this situation. This shouldn't have lasted 44 minutes.
When you hear these arguments about people saying, well, I need to have protection, and people say, well, you have to wait for the police. And now the police are saying, don't make us wait for the SWAT. Let us have the correct firepower at hand if we need it, because a shotgun or, you know, a Glock 9mm isn't going to get this job done. And so now the LAPD said, okay, our officers will start to carry 45 caliber weapons. That will be their duty sidearm.
And the Department of Defense gives 600 surplus M16s to the LAPD. I know this isn't armored personnel vehicles and all of the militarization that we see today, but I really feel like this is the catalyst. This is the thing that happened in society that started to change the way our police forces function.
In June of 1998, the LA Police Department's chief of police, Bernard C. Parks, released a memorandum, and it was a collection of data on the shootout about how they responded with their firearms to this incident. And I guess you could say it's a way for them to utilize this incident and going forward, have a better understanding of what worked, what didn't, and what they needed to change.
Well, and the interesting thing about this is back in 1997, mass shootings weren't as popular or as frequent as they are today. So police responded to this as a bank robbery. Even though shots were fired inside the bank, it wasn't exactly a mass shooting situation where they might have gone into the bank and tried to engage these robbers, because it wasn't on anyone's mind that they were in there killing everyone in the bank. Even though they heard shots being fired, they stayed outside. This might have been a totally different situation if it happened today. They might assume that it's a disgruntled bank employee or a mass shooting. Secondly, the police officers would have AR-15s on them, and when they shot these bank robbers, they would have gone down as opposed to walking around like Michael Myers or Jason, and just nothing seems to even faze them.
The 19 officers that were involved in this shootout, they were given the Los Angeles Police Medal of Valor for their heroic actions, and they even met with then-President Bill Clinton. The officers were Officer Don Anderson, Detective Tracy Angeles, Detective Vincent Bancroft Jr., Officer Edward Brentlinger, Officer Anthony Cubno, Officer John Caparelli, Detective Thomas Culotta, Officer Edwin Dominguez, Officer Stephen Gomez, Detective Kevin Hurley, Officer Richard Massa, Sergeant Israel Medina, Officer Charles Perguet, Officer Todd Schmitz, Officer Conrado Torres, Detective Lawrence Winston, Detective Philip Wixom, and Officer James Zaborovin, and Officer Richard Zielinski.
Now, there were upwards to 100 police officers on site that day, but it was these officers who were engaged with the bank robbers the entire time, were shot or protected other people from being shot.
Let's talk again about Matasarenu's death, because that video where he's lying there bleeding to death, and it appears that the officers are pretty much indifferent. His children actually filed a lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department for what they said was intentionally allowing him to bleed out. And this was taken to the United States District Court in February and March of 2000. How did that end up, Justin?
Well, I'm a little surprised that they would take them to court over this, but then again, should I be? I don't know. But it would end up with a mistrial. The jury was deadlocked, and the family would end up dropping the lawsuit.
I believe it was dropped because there was the possibility that they would be countersued if they didn't drop it.
Countersued for legal fees by the city. I understand why they would be upset if they felt that their family member was left to die, but it just seems that they didn't really take into account that their family member had just engaged the entire LAPD and tried to murder them. It seems to be lost upon the family. I don't think anyone deserves to bleed out and die in the middle of the street, but I think we could choose somebody else that might deserve some more sympathy.
There was an investigation by the Los Angeles Times, which has put out a number of great articles on this situation, on this incident. In 2017, they determined that a series of mishaps and mistakes, which they claim were mainly by paramedics, was really the reason for Matasarenu bleeding to death on the ground. Take that for what you will. I'm sure that won't satisfy everyone, especially Matasarenu's family. But whatever happened, we can all agree that it was Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Matasarenu that caused this whole incident. There is a film that came out in 2003 titled 44 Minutes in the North Hollywood Shootout. You know, you can say it was inspired by or is about this this shootout that took place in North Hollywood. Have you seen it, Justin?
Yes, I have. It's great. I thought it was very well done. I think it's very much based in reality. They don't Hollywood it out much. Something that does get talked about a lot is how these guys liked the movie Heat. If you've ever seen it, I think the movie's a little too long, but there is a bank robbery scene in the middle of that movie that probably is one of the most intense, crazy bank robbery scenes that Hollywood has ever put out. And these guys might have been inspired by that. And if you're ever in Los Angeles, you can go by the LAPD's museum where they have an exhibit showcasing the body armor that the bank robbers were wearing, along with their car and the weapons they used. They actually have mannequins. It looks like the whole scene from the bank robbery. It's kind of interesting if you're into that. People have questioned how these guys got their hands on these weapons. People assume that fully automatic rifles were legal at that time. They were not. Fully automatic weapons have been regulated in our country for a very long time. Started back in 1934, there was the National Firearms Act. Then there was the Gun Control Act of 1968. Signed into law by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and this was further regulations towards fully automatic weapons and what Americans were allowed to buy, and the federal assault weapons ban had little to do with what these men were carrying or their access to it. These weapons they had were already illegal for them to be in possession of. And the assault weapons ban is really just an aesthetics law that gun manufacturers got around very easily. So it had very little impact, at least on this bank robbery, this shootout. So any fully automatic weapons were highly illegal by the 1990s. Funny story, my grandfather, who was a full bird lieutenant colonel in the Army, he came back from, I think, World War II with a German submachine gun that was fully automatic, and I guess let a friend borrow it. Somehow it got into the hands of somebody that wanted to show it off to a bunch of people, and he actually showed it off to a member of law enforcement at some point, and the weapon got confiscated. The FBI got involved, found out where he got the gun, where my grandfather got the gun. So my grandfather had the FBI show up on his doorstep and question him about this fully automatic submachine gun that was claimed to be in his possession.
Justin, one question that really stands out to me about this whole shootout is, why do you believe that Larry Phillips Jr. stood and fought? I mean, why did he engage the police in a shootout? I mean, you can look at it and say he's got the weapons advantage, but he's outnumbered and they can keep calling more officers to the scene. So what do you think happened there?
Yeah, I mean, when he walks out of the bank, they could have just gotten in their getaway vehicle and tried to take off. But instead, he just starts shooting. I look at it two ways. One, the botched bank robbery. This could have been just pure frustration and just screw it. I'm gonna shoot at all of you. Or it could be, I hate cops. I hate all of you. I hate authority. This is all instilled by his father. Just rage. Could be as simple as that.
The Los Angeles Times, there's a brilliant article on this. And what I like about it is they actually have quotes from Larry Phillips Jr.'s father. He said he watches that shootout thinking that it'll make him strong, but it ruins him. Now, it's no surprise that a father would love his son, but the way he speaks of his son, it's like he is proud of his son for being what he calls a criminal genius and being the bravest man in the world. And if there was any doubt about where Junior got his inspiration for the way he would run his life, you don't have to look farther than his father. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.